Meandering in the margins of medicine, it's the Shortcoat Podcast.
Everyone, it's the Shortcoat Podcast, and I am, as I always am, Dave Etler. And today I'm joined by Nathan Miller and Aline Sanduk.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
A fact for which I'm grateful, because otherwise I'd have no one to talk to about the latest news and events in medicine and medical education and other things. And who better to turn to for insightful news analysis than these fine people? Thanks for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
As always, happy to be here.
I have to start off on some sad news. And I want to start right off by acknowledging it. This is a loss for humanity, a loss for medicine, a loss for science in general. And I'm speaking, of course, of the loss of five gecko lizards who were sent to space by Russians to have sex.
I saw that.
And who probably never got any before they froze to death due to an equipment malfunction.
It's tragic.
That is tragic. But they did manage to contribute to society in one way. And, you know, because their lives were so short, so brief, they're, you know, they had so much to give, and it just didn't happen for the most part. But they did contribute one thing. I have now have a fantastic new band name to consider: the Russian Sex Geckos.
The Russian Sex Geckos.
Actually, that's a great band
Isn't
name.
It a fantastic band name?
That's pretty good.
That's courtesy. Actually, I did not think that up. That was courtesy of the BBC's always entertaining RSS headlines. So when you subscribe to an RSS feed from the BBC. Their headlines are slightly different always from the main headline. The main headlines are often entertaining or confusing enough. There's something about British headlines that are just like, I don't understand what you mean. But the RSS headlines always add an extra bit of fun. And so the headline from their feed was "Russian Sex Geckos Freeze to Death," or something like that.
Awesome. Their lives did have a purpose: to give you a cool band name and also to entertain us.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. And I think that is a...
Much was gained from this experiment.
Exactly. Poor Russian geckos. The fruit flies, by the way, did survive and reproduce. So I guess there's that.
There's a silver lining.
So they know exactly why the geckos died? You said they froze?
Equipment malfunction. Okay. Yeah. Well, probably.
That's unfortunate.
They don't know for sure how long they survived in space, but they suspect that it wasn't long. I wonder, did the geckos know that they were on their way for sex, to space for sex, and they were like, sweet, zero grav sex, you know, that's always, in science fiction, that's always like, you know.
That's the dream.
The dream, and then they were like, it's a little cold in here.
And they don't have to buy dinner.
That's okay, we'll just get warmer through, you know, a little body.
Although they're reptiles, don't they? Like, I don't know.
Cold blood.
Yeah, I don't know how that works exactly.
Will you stop with your science, Nathan?
Ruining the party
with logic.
That's
probably the problem there, yeah.
You and your science. What have you guys been doing?
I'm not very cool and I don't get out very much.
Studying for foundations. That is what I've been doing.
Pretty much.
Did you go to the football game last weekend?
I went to the football game last weekend. Yeah, the season opener. It was okay. We won.
See, I know nothing about football. You know, the only reason I asked that? Because I feel like it's expected of me living in Iowa.
Yeah, pretty
kind
much.
Of a big deal on the side of the river, at least.
It's a big deal everywhere. You know, where I come from in Massachusetts, it's a big deal probably at the University of Massachusetts that there's a football game. But I don't know that throughout the state people are as rabid, because they've got like the Patriots and whatever else. I hate sports.
That's kind of always been my theory as well. You've got really no major professional sports teams throughout the state. So people come here from all over.
There's no competition.
Yeah, exactly.
They drive their giant RVs to a parking lot that's distant from the actual stadium to drink and watch large screen TVs of the football game.
It's so decadent.
Yeah.
On one hand, I think that'd be a lot of fun, but I mean...
Oh, if I had a 40-foot long RV, I would do it.
If I had that kind of money, I'd probably spend it in a different way, or I don't know.
If I had enough money for... If I had like 200 grand for a 40-foot long RV and a big screen TV and a bunch of booze-themed umbrellas and a black and gold... pair of overalls.
I take back what I said before. That is the dream. That right there is the dream. Yeah.
Black and gold overalls.
Obviously.
That's the thing that
someday, Elaine, we can come back and have a class party with our RVs.
Why didn't you open with that? Why didn't you open with that? Let's do that.
I went to a game years ago, and I had to leave. It was too claustrophobic, and people were sitting in our seats, and I was like, I don't know what to do. And they were like, everybody's screaming. And
it's part of the fun. At least that's why there's all the drinking occurs, I think. It makes that more fun versus just difficult to tolerate if you're sober.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Nathan, you're an EMT for games.
Yeah, I started as an EMT back in like 2010, I think, while doing my undergrad here and at Johnson County Ambulance Service. Mm-hmm. And they have a deal with or contract with the university athletic department. So we do like football, basketball, stuff like that. So we get to
practice,
keep an eye on people and
practice sure dealing with people who have had too much to drink.
Yeah, I suppose so to some extent.
If you become an emergency physician, you will probably benefit from this experience quite a bit.
Probably, especially in a university town like this.
Yeah.
Where the ER is directly across from the stadium.
That's it's a good thought. I think somebody was really planning.
Good urban planning.
When they did that. Well, all right. Have you been to, you've been to a game? You went to this past week? You said you went to the...
No, I traveled to the area where the game was being played and kind of milled around just for the experience of being...
It's wild in Iowa City.
In the mix, yeah.
It's
it was
wild.
Very anxiety-provoking. I had to get out of there almost immediately after I got there. I thought, oh, this is great, and now I gotta go. So.
Do you also suffer from large crowd claustrophobia?
I practice a form of... yeah, biological osmosis in the sense that I like...
Not sounds
osmosis,
gross.
Diffusion. All I right. like to maintain a certain
yeah,
space around me.
I really do, too. It's yeah. it's important.
Yeah.
Well, like I say, I got claustrophobic at a game, and I actually left to go to my office and do work.
Yeah.
That's how bad it was.
It's a lot of people. And it's not people calmly milling around. It's they're rowdy. They're drinking. They're enjoying themselves. It's loud.
Mm-hmm.
It can be fun if you're also drinking. But if you don't drink... It can be an adjustment to your life.
Are you a non-drinker mostly?
I do not drink alcohol.
Oh.
Yep.
Well, that makes one of us. Nice. Well, good. What else? Anything else? There's, you know, I'll tell you what. I'll tell you what I'm doing this past week. Actually, throughout the summer, I've been writing medical student performance evaluation.
Oh, fun.
These are the documents that... we're formerly called the Dean's Letters, and they'll be sent off to residency programs will be able to look at them and sort of, I don't know, make a first cut of students to interview, I guess.
Mm-hmm. No pressure or anything.
It's a hell of a process.
What kind of information is included in these letters?
So there is a sort of standard that the LCME, the Liaison Committee of Medical Education, sort of wants
more acronyms,
right?
Fun.
Yeah. And so it includes like a unique characteristics paragraph, which basically, you know, lists the students' accomplishments and their the clubs even that they belong to and their publications and awards and, you know, things that they do in their sort of extracurricular time. And then it goes into, you know, goes into your you know, of course it lists your grades for your basic science, or it lists whether you got honors or near honors for your basic science courses in your FCP, or actually now your medicine society caps, all that kind of stuff, your all your, you know, courses. And then it lists all the comments and the grades for your clerkships up to a certain point in the year. And we spend a lot of time, you know, like taking out the redundant comments or the formative comments, like, this is fascinating, isn't it? The formative comments, the things like needs to read more and, you know, should, you know, work on this, and leave in the summative ones like, he's awesome and he, you know, she did great work in this area and really helped us do this. And of course the problem comes when there is a pattern of negative comments. We sort of have to acknowledge those in the MSP, tell the story basically. So it's a big process. There's a lot of people in OSAC involved in putting those together. Me and another person do the writing, and then the faculty directors and the deans do some of it, and, you know, the registrar's office gives us a lot. So anyway, fascinating story.
I'm enthralled. I don't know.
You should
Nathan.
Be. What's nice is I have a file of ridiculous quotes. From residency, from the clerkship comments. Okay. So I imagine that these are, I don't get to see the names of who wrote them. I just see the comments themselves. But I imagine they're from tired, overworked residents who really are not thinking about exactly what they're writing about. And so, you know, I get comments like, he's a great leaner. A quick leaner.
Quite a credential.
Yeah. Which I think probably means the exact opposite of what you might want to see in your comps. I've got a ton of them, and I wish I could read them on the air, but I'm really afraid to because, you know, they're kind
someone
of...
Someone might recognize
they're kind of... Work. Yeah, they're someone might recognize their work, although I doubt it. But also, they're kind of...
Can be controversial.
Yeah, you know, but it would
we
be...
We understand.
It would be. I actually considered it, and nobody really told me, no, you can't do it, but... Yeah.
It might be one of those things where you have to ask for permission rather than
Yeah, and I didn't... What I didn't do was keep a record of who's... comments there. It's just like it's just a list, and they're pretty funny.
Are there regular offenders? Or
oh, I have no like I have no idea. Oh, okay, okay. I have no idea who wrote the comments.
Gotcha.
And sometimes they're like things like, you know, he made great cookies, which is nice. Or he needs it. Yeah, I can't.
So that probably goes right into the letter then, because that would be a huge.
Yeah, exactly. You would think, but no, we take.
They frown upon that.
I don't think anybody really frowns upon it. It's just. You know,
I mean,
maybe the decision to hire a resident should not be based on their baking skills.
Well, I feel like it'd be worth mentioning if I was selecting a resident for my program and it came down to two people who were about even and one made great cookies.
Are your patients going to benefit from your cookies, though?
Yeah, totally.
Well,
I guess
they may enjoy the resident's great cookies.
Yeah, well, I guess the increase in morale that one experiences after eating a cookie in, you know, whatever department you work in, that could benefit the patient.
That could improve outcomes.
Absolutely. They should do a study. You should do a study.
There we go. Got research for the summer.
Yeah. Well, we will be right back in just a second on the Short Code Podcast.
Inside Stories is an oral narratives project that catalogs the stories of medical students during their journeys through medical school. The podcast is hosted on In Training, the online magazine for medical students. Visit us at in-training.org/inside-stories. Inside Stories is a founding member of Vocalis, the podcast network for medical students. Please listen to our partner podcasts at vocalisnetwork.wix.com/listen.
You guys, on this very podcast this past spring, episode 25, we were privileged to talk with the descendants of Henrietta Lacks about their ancestors' unwitting contribution to the study of cancer through her DNA. The you may have heard of the HeLa cells.
For sure.
Yeah. So this is the first immortal cell line, if you're not familiar with HeLa. Through some quirk of her genetics, these cells were the first that were able to just sort of continuously reproduce. And that's very important for the study of a lot of different things, including cancer, which she was a victim of. So go back and listen to that episode, because it's an interesting discussion on the issue of informed consent and privacy in the business of medical research. And the family members we spoke to, Mrs. Lacks, grandson David, and great-granddaughter Victoria, were really interesting. Well, this week... I mean, the problem is that for years, the family never knew that their ancestor's genome was so heavily used, and that her cells, the first immortal cell line, as I said, were still alive in labs around the world. And when they found out recently, this past spring, that Henrietta's genome had been made public for the world to see, they had real concerns about their own privacy as it related to their genetics. Fortunately, this last week, the NIH announced a new agreement with the family. The genome data will be available only if someone applies to it. The family will be represented by two of its members on a board, which will review the applications. And anyone who uses the information in their research will be asked to acknowledge the Lacks family. No financial compensation involved, despite the fact that billions literally have been made on this woman's genetics. So it's a big big victory for ethics, I think.
That is huge.
It's still an interesting question, though, because you'll have, you know, the family members. So while this patient, consented to have her information, or the family.
There was no consent.
This was like, I think, in the 50s.
This was in the 50s.
Oh, was it?
Absolutely no consent. Yeah. Poor black woman in...
It was at Johns Hopkins.
Yeah, it's at Hopkins, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Not to give Hopkins a bad name or
no,
anything.
No, no. I mean, this was... I don't know that this was an... I think this was not an uncommon practice. I mean, you just... Yeah. You know, the attitude back then was, well, these are cells. They're not, you know, so we're just going to take them.
All right. Well, in that case, it's not very gray. But if someone today were to consent to give their genetic information for research, you're basically... The rest of your family is also tied into it, like you were saying. There's, you know, your kids are going to have half the same genetic information as you are, roughly. Yeah. And, you know, they're directly tied in by your consent versus, like, if you're working with a donor in the anatomy lab, the rest of the family isn't directly tied into it.
Right.
It's kind of an interesting ethical dilemma.
Right. Yeah, the interesting thing, and if you go back and listen to episode 25, a lot of this came out from a book by Rebecca Skloot, I think, if I recall correctly her name. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, one of the things that the book really highlighted was how poor and uneducated these this family was back then. I mean, not only did they not know what DNA was, they didn't know what cells were. They didn't know anything that would equip them to understand with the understanding of what was going on. So they literally thought for years that their mother, their actual mother or grandmother, was still alive. Like they had made a new one.
Oh,
mm-hmm. I mean that was the sort of the difficulty that they faced was just, you know, not only understanding the issue of informed consent, but just getting back to like the very, very super basics of what was going on here. So
yeah, but you have to remember the structure of DNA wasn't even elucidated until about the mid-50s, I think, yeah. 1956.
Right. So there was that also. I mean, just, yeah. You know.
They knew it existed. They didn't know what it looked like or how it worked exactly.
Yeah.
So a lot of ignorance all around.
Yep. Yeah, that's true. I mean, even the researchers didn't, you know, couldn't have known that this would be information that potentially could, you know, screw somebody over someday.
But I think living in this country, everyone intuitively knows what property is and what belongs to you and what belongs to someone else. And just by that very basic fact, they should have taken that into account and included her in the decision to use this material.
Well, sure. And, you know, I think informed consent is a relatively recent development.
True.
In medical research. So, well, I'm glad that they reached this agreement. I'm glad that they didn't say. I guess we should be grateful. We should be grateful that the Lax family is sort of allowing this to, you know, this sort of research to continue with some limits. I think they're very practical and, you know, reasonable limits. So
yeah, these cells do a lot of good, and the fact that they just wanted to be included but not like all out stop all research involving these cells is a very, very magnanimous.
Right. Do you have something you want to talk about, Nathan? You look like you have something you want to talk about.
Yeah, a little bit.
You have that look on your face like, I want to talk about something, dude.
It's not super structured here, but so obviously in the news and Facebook and everything for the past month or so has been the ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. Raising, this week, I think they passed $100 million raised for the ALS Association, I think that's what it's called, here in the United States, which is great. Charitable organization who will put money towards research and, you know, coming up with a cure for ALS. I read an article that raised some questions about where money goes, like where charitable donations go relative to, who's affected by disease. I guess that was really poorly worded, but like heart disease is the number one killer in the United States, followed by, I think, cancers if you group them together, and then like COPD maybe after that, while donations have nothing to do with that correlation as well. So
so the gist is that, you know, yes, this is important research, but there are killers out there that
yeah,
the money
so
too.
A couple of the big ones like heart disease and COPD are mostly preventable diseases, or at least you could postpone death a significant amount if you, you know, lived a healthy life or, you know, whatever, avoided the risk factors for it. So
but
I guess
that,
just...
That would kill
ahead.
Jobs if we regulated what we put into the environment. That
oh,
would,
gosh.
That would hurt the economy.
Heavens.
Sorry to interrupt.
Well, on the federal government level, I also found that I think it's directly the NIH, I'm not exactly sure, but it breaks down like large categories of research by like dollars spent per fiscal year, which I found interesting. Like the top major category is in genetics, which has like $7.1 billion in fiscal year 13, followed by like biotechnology, neurosciences, cancer, infectious diseases, versus the charitable organizations where you have, I think, like breast cancer is one of the highest ones. Cancers in general, actually, I think really highly funded, even though, you know, some of them are very specific. And now ALS is obviously jumping up where they have like, I think this is what ALS Ice Bucket Challenge. They've raised like 3 times as much money as they have in, you know, like last year combined. Anyways, I don't know. I just found it interesting that these don't seem to, I mean, the federal government seems to correlate fairly well with the actual causes of death, you know, like prevention is huge. So
they're spending on is what yeah. they're
so
spending on these.
What is diseases? It about these diseases that do get funded through donations that makes them so popular?
Well, I mean, we first of all, we've got marketing. This ALS Ice Bucket Challenge turns out to have been a genius in, I don't know if it's the ALS Association came up with this. I literally don't know, but whoever came up with it, I mean, turns out to have been a very smart play.
It capitalizes on everyone's desire to fit in and to be fashionable.
Yeah, and to, you know, have a potential YouTube fail video. I think we've all been entertained by people dropping large buckets of water on. By the way, has anybody else noticed this? Many of the Ice Bucket Challenge videos I've watched have not been ice water.
No, it's turned into just kind of like a small bowl full of water.
A small bowl full of room temperature water.
I don't remember the cause. I feel like I should. But over the winter, I know there were some videos of people like jumping into cold lakes and, you know, frozen over lakes, which I think was like called a cold water challenge. Maybe. Okay. I don't remember what it was for exactly. Maybe it was ALS. That was the origins, or maybe it was something similar.
Yeah.
I know someone out there is probably yelling at their iPod or whatever. But that seemed like a lot more of a commitment, jumping into a frozen lake. They had to like cut a circle out of in order to get into,
yeah,
you know, versus pouring some water on your head. But
well, and wasn't it supposed to be like either you donate or you pour an ice bucket? A bucket full of ice water on yourself.
I've seen all the variations from you donate both ways, you donate more if you don't do it. I think like I've seen like $100 if you don't participate, $10 if you do, and then like you nominate other people. Other times people just nominate other people and don't do anything else. I don't know. I've seen kind of the whole selection.
There's a broad variation.
Yeah. But it does. I mean, obviously, it's worked great.
No, it doesn't matter. It was a stroke of genius, and I'm sure that whoever came up with it in the first place probably didn't realize that it was going to go quite so far. Where we have, you know, people like Patrick Stewart and William Shatner. I don't know who. Probably, you know, Bill Gates. People.
A lot of people. Yeah, a lot of celebrities.
So
it's good for raising awareness. But I think the most important question at the end of the day is, where is all this money going? Because
we'll find out. I mean, I think that the amount of attention that this has gotten. Do we know at this point?
I think it's going to the ALS.
Yeah.
Sorry, the ALS Association.
Right, but I mean, do we know, like? You know, so I did read, and I wish I'd paid attention closer to this article, but I did read that, you know, $100 million, it's not a tremendous amount of money research wise. But
really?
I don't know.
You don't think so?
Don't look at me. I'm just telling you what I read. I don't like actually analyze what I read. I don't think about what I read, Aline. Right there.
Yeah.
Forgot, you know.
I'm just kidding.
I don't have a great sense of it, but I mean, it is. Just this challenge has produced 3 times as much money as they had for the entire past year. So that's huge. It's over the past couple months, and a half maybe.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money relative to what they've had before to work with.
Yeah. If you think about it, if you're a scientist and you apply for an R01 grant from the NIH, it's a multi-million dollar grant that you get. Well, if you're an institution that applies for that. So if you have $100 million, you could potentially fund 20 to 30 different institutions to do research in this area. I think that's significant.
Well, there you go.
You also think about like sustainable work, though, if you're in their situation. So you can't just spend that $100 million now, because then you're going to pay all these labs to do research, and then next year comes around and there's no ALS Ice Bucket Challenge and everyone's just left out to dry versus having continuing research over the next decade to maybe find I don't know. I haven't done that much research, so I don't know how that works.
Yeah, really, we don't do research on this. It's not that important. Did you have anything else you wanted to bring up today?
I'll leave it at that.
Whoa.
At least.
That's kind of rude. All right.
I have an interesting story.
Yeah.
Go for it, Elaine.
I know. Surprising. So there was a story not too long ago about a potentially new form of birth control for males involving a gel that is injected into the vas deferens.
No.
Yeah.
No. Just kidding.
I know. It sounds nightmarish. But it's been proven to be quite effective. And so they did simian trials and found it to be very effective there. And now it's already in the initial stages of human trials.
So they are injecting caulking, basically.
Yeah.
They're plugging it up.
So they don't exactly know how it works. All they know is that... Well, so I have the scientific name of it, but it doesn't really matter.
I want to hear the scientific name too. The scientific name of the...
So the trade name is Valsalgel. Valsalgel? Yeah.
That's reasonable. Like that. That's good marketing.
Yeah. So what it's actually made of is a copolymer of styrene and maleic anhydride. They mix that...
Styrene. That sounds familiar. Something to do with... coffee cups and
listen, just
plastic. All right, go ahead.
No tunnel vision here. So that gets mixed with dimethyl sulfoxide, and then they irradiate this mixture and inject it into the vas deferens. So basically what happens is they think that this polymer just like dissipates and coats the inside of the vas deferens, which is where, you know,
sperm gets made,
right? Well, where right? It passes through,
okay,
on its way to better times. So,
yes.
I was wondering where you're going to go with that, but I like that.
Did you enjoy that? Yeah. Analogies are a pastime of mine.
That's good.
So, the beginning of the procedure is a lot like what you would do for a vasectomy, but instead of like clipping the vas deferens, they just inject this. And what they thought for a while that it lowered the pH, which basically disrupts the protein in the sperm.
Sure.
And they're not effective. Mm. Then they thought that maybe it... Dr. Wikipedia says that because it's an anhydride, maybe it hydrolyzes in the presence of water in the spermatic fluid. They're not really sure, but it seems to be effective.
So I just wonder how this... So they're not really sure, but I wonder how this sort of thing comes about. Like that would be interesting to find out the origin of this idea.
Right.
Because they must have had some... inkling that this particular or were they just like, let's just inject this in like 100 different places in the body and see what happens. Yeah. I mean, a significant amount of science happens that way, I think. For instance, you take some, when they're looking for bioreactive, compounds, they take a bunch of cells and they squirt,
various things
on it and like look and see what happens.
Especially in old school medicine where physicians would just like do crazy stuff to themselves.
Yeah.
Or other people,
yeah. In the 50s, whatever, to a lady at Johns Hopkins. So I think a lot of science starts as one thing and then evolves into another.
So they thought it would do this and then it turned out to do something else.
Maybe. I don't know the whole backstory. It's fascinating. For example, Viagra started out as heart medication.
Right.
Right? Latisse, that prescription that was really popular a couple years ago that made your eyelashes longer, that started as a glaucoma medication.
Yeah.
And then they found out they could market it in a better way.
So maybe they just noticed lower sperm counts or something.
Maybe.
People who were for people who were eating coffee cups.
Yeah. I think it's totally reversible. Yes. I'm not sure, but I think
it's like flush it out then or something.
I think it degrades over time. It's like the male version of an IUD for a woman.
Hmm.
Although an IUD doesn't degrade over time, but it lasts for so many years. Whoops.
If you have a drug one, I think degrades.
Yeah, they have the implants for.
Yeah. Yeah, that's there. You go. Maybe that's a better.
Well, that's very interesting. It's got to be better. In a lot of ways than a vasectomy, I guess. Even vasectomies aren't that horrible, I hear.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's a good alternative for, as opposed to like placing the burden on a female.
Absolutely.
To, raise this very controversial issue of using contraception.
Yes.
Now you can remove the physical barrier that, a lot of people aren't big fans of when they're engaging in this activity. So
I want to project the impression that I'm not a Neanderthal, so I am in total agreement.
Okay.
I also feel like you're further decreasing your chances of having an accidency.
Right.
So
absolutely.
Yeah. Great.
Sort of along those lines, you were talking about implants just a moment ago. LSU MD PhD student Jeffrey Wiseman co-led a team, and they were challenged by their professor to come up with an innovative use of 3D printing, which is always something that catches my eye, as regular listeners will remember. So they came up with a way to use consumer-grade 3D printers to create medical implants that deliver chemo and antibiotic drugs. So they basically mix the medication with a bioreactive material that can be, or a biocompatible material that can be extruded by a 3D printer into like a disc shape, or, you know, any shape that you want, obviously. And those are implanted, and the implant, instead of having to be removed, just gets absorbed. And because the drugs are part of the substrate, the delivery is more controlled, safer. And best of all, because the printers are consumer grade, it means that they can be used anywhere instead of in a, you know, in a
industrial setting or in a
hospital setting or something like that. So kind of cool. Yeah, interesting use of 3D printers, and marginally connected to what you just said.
Yeah, I would say so. So much potential for 3D printing.
Yeah.
On that note, I did also run into an article. I have it up here, but I've actually read the whole thing.
Yeah, that's fine.
About a 12-year-old in China who had a 3D printed individual implanted after having some sort of cancer. I guess some of it had to be removed. And it was like a mix. I think it was like some sort of mesh that allowed for like bone ingrowth, maybe. But it didn't sound like it degraded. I don't know. I should probably read more about it. But I don't know. It'd be interesting in a situation like that in a 12-year-old how that would work when they grow.
From the story I read, which I think is the same story, they did have to wait until the spine had stopped growing.
Okay.
So there was some. If it's the same story.
More and more applications on a weekly basis now are kind of
exactly where every week I have to talk about it. Maybe people would like me to shut up.
No, not at all. Live your passion, Dave.
It's exciting.
My passion. If I had the mental capacity to be a doctor, I would be doing things along those lines.
Also, yay, biomedical engineering.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right on. Nice shout out there.
Yeah. I knew there was a reason I took that CAD class.
Interesting opinion piece in the New York Times about physicians who commit suicide.
Oof.
Yeah.
That got serious real fast.
I'm
Dave.
Sorry.
That's okay.
You know, but it's, you know,
it's an important topic.
Here's why it's important. The NIH says physicians are more than twice as likely to take their own lives as non-physicians. And female physicians are three times more likely than male physicians.
Damn it.
Yeah.
It's never good for
us. No. Academic Medicine reports that 9.4% of fourth-year medical students and interns reported having suicidal thoughts in the last 2 weeks.
Wow.
So 9.4% doesn't sound like much. Only the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, but it's one in 10. That is a lot.
And 2 weeks, like you said, that's crazy.
The last 2 weeks of med school?
No, just in the past two the weeks last of two the weeks survey.
Of the survey, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it's a big deal.
I wonder what percentage of incoming med students have a history of depression, because those people would be at the greatest risk.
I don't have the figures in front of me, but I know that somewhere around a quarter of people in their 20s have some sort of depressive episode, some sort of clinical, potentially clinical.
Yeah, it's remarkably common, and to be on antidepressants. People should not feel bad for being on that type of medication.
Well, here's what this piece suggests, and of course, as usual, I'll post the link to it, because I think it's really important that all medical students and all interns all residents at least look at this, because the piece suggests that there's a sort of macho attitude by doctors to project intellectual and emotional strength more than they truly possess, maybe more than anyone can truly possess, in the face of these this extreme challenge, extremely challenging environment of medical education, of the intern year especially, probably. And, you know, they're supposed to just constantly be rock steady.
Yeah.
Right? And there's a disconnect between the medical school understanding that the knowledge will come given experience, right? Like, that's what you're told.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. In time, it will come. And the intern year in which, you know, sort of self-expectation is that, the expectations just become extreme. You know, like, oh, I'm a real doctor now. I have to know what I'm doing. So, you know, sort of the fatigue and the error, you know, the fatigue, errors, fear, you know, even minor errors sort of probably bring up that whole
invincibility.
You know, paradigm. You know, this could have been a lot worse, and that causes more fear, coupled with a sort of this need to project competency, probably are contributing factors.
It's just a rough environment. I mean, especially in, like you're saying, the intern year, I guess even your like clerkships or rotations in medical school, I can't remember exactly what the rest of them are called, but pathways, I think is what we're calling them. Mm-hmm. I don't know, I guess it's, you are expected to know a lot. You're always in a new environment, so you're working with new people, you're expected to know new things. It's almost like a losing battle, yeah, as far as feeling confident about anything. And plus, you're trying to apply all this information for the first time ever.
It seems to me, though, that you know, a supportive environment by one's colleagues is probably very helpful. But not only that, you know, it may need to be more formal than that. I mean, when we're talking about support groups for interns, I mean, that might go a long way towards, you know, almost the admission of, I mean, I think it sounds to me like there is a sort of overall culture of non-admission of mistakes.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Of
there's
either fooling oneself or fooling everybody else into the understanding that, you know, I'm invincible.
Yeah. There's an NPR podcast about exactly this. Is that where you heard of this?
That's where I'm going.
Yeah. Okay.
That's
all
where
right.
I'm going. Maybe
let
where
me not
I'm going.
Foreshadow.
No, that's fine, because the next thing I was going to talk about was Brian Goldman was featured on the TED Radio Hour.
That's right.
He's the host of White Coat Black Arts on CBC Radio.
I'm so excited we listen to the same stuff. I aspire to be as cool as you do.
Well.
It's awesome.
It really can't be done.
But a girl can dream. A girl can dream.
Yeah. I mean, I think you're putting yourself out there. You're putting extreme pressure on yourself, and
I know.
As we know, that's a problem.
I'm ambitious. It's okay.
All right, just acknowledge that you might not be able to do it. He's been exploring medical mistakes on his show for years, and this sort of all comes out. It comes out of his own mistakes that he acknowledges now.
Mm-hmm.
And he encourages his guests to talk about them on the show. And he says that the common story told by physicians that their worst mistakes happen in their first 5 years is crap.
Yeah.
And if you can't talk about mistakes, how can you learn from them, and how can you teach others? Now, there are mechanisms, as I understand it, to talk about mistakes, but they, you know, like the tumor board. No, that's not the right word.
Review board?
Yeah. I don't know why I said tumor board. But they you know, they have these groups that get together and sort of talk about why somebody died.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
And
yeah, like
they
the
seem...
Morbidity and
that's
mortality
what I'm,
people.
Yes, that's
yeah,
what I'm...
panel. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, no kidding.
My impression of those is that they are in some ways intended to get at the truth and to uncover, you know, maybe a mistake or a procedural inadequacy, you know, an institutional inadequacy or something like that, which is very, you know, admirable. But I think that they can be somewhat adversarial in different types of cultures.
I would agree. I mean, I guess we're extremely preclinical still, but I feel like you'd almost feel like you're being reviewed by those, or being criticized by those people, rather than, I guess maybe it is a developmental thing where they'll like explain how you could do better in the future, and maybe it's not like harsh or anything, but I feel like I would be failing to be like, I have failed, and that's
defensiveness
why I'm here.
Is, yeah. You know, like it's in that situation, I mean, of course you're going to feel like, you know, you're judged, and physicians are human. Physicians make mistakes. So the idea is to learn from them in a culture that fosters a loving, supporting environment that encourages the discussion of mistakes, according to Goldman.
Yeah.
Especially in the U.S., where there are, you know, where he says there are, or this opinion piece says there are 100,000 deaths from preventable errors. And he thinks that that's actually a gross underestimation.
Wow. I believe that.
So, but I did want to play a quote from that TED Radio Hour because, I don't know, I just thought it was, you know, he's fighting the good fight, I feel like.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the greatest successes in medicine come from failure. They don't get planned out and executed perfectly the first time. You know, there are wondrous treatments that exist today on the backs of people who died. And I can tell you, I've saved a lot of people off the backs of the people who paid for my mistakes.
I think that's a very brave thing to say.
That's so powerful.
Yeah.
And it's true.
So, on that rather sobering note, good luck out there, and thanks for coming, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dave.
The Short Code is produced by the Writing and Humanities Program at the University of Iowa Carver College of Medicine with support from Medical Student Government. You can visit us online at theshortcoat.com, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter too, where we post not only our episodes but news and info for medical students. We also take comments and story ideas from you, our listeners, via email at theshortcoats@gmail.com, or leave us a voice message at 347-SHORT-CT. That's 347-746-7828. The producers are Jason T. Lewis and David T. Etler. Our opening music is by Dude Skywalker, and our closing theme music is by RAC. Thanks for listening. But what I see's a child. Your eyes, your eyes.